Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. And today's program is part two of a three-part series, Updates in the Treatment of Estrogen Receptor, or ER-positive, Progesterone Receptor, TR-positive, and HER2-positive breast cancer from the 39th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And so today you're going to hear updates really on the hormonal treatment of breast cancer and targeted treatments as well. This is an amazing program. We have, this is something we do every year, and so there are lots of you on the call today. And we have many collaborating organizations that work with us to make this program possible. So we have many cancer organizations and breast cancer-specific organizations. And it really is because of their collaboration that we have so many of you on the call today. So we have over 983 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we have international participants from Canada, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us to really learn more about this particular type of breast cancer. And today's program is supported by AbbVie, the Celgene Corporation, a contribution from Lilly, Novartis Oncology, and Pfizer. And I really want to thank them for their support not only of today's program, but of this three-part series. And I also just want to thank them for their collaboration and corporate sponsorship of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on the program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Charles Lipinski. Dr. Lipinski is the Regents Professor of Breast Cancer Research, Division of Medical Oncology, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Lipinski is going to address the hormonal treatments of breast cancer. And he is also going to talk about new targeted treatments for breast cancer. And it's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Lipinski.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to be back on this call again. The topic I'm going to address today is talk about estrogen receptor related treatments, anti-estrogen therapy or hormonal therapy. There are receptors on many cancer cells, estrogen receptors and progesterone receptors, and there also are HER2 new receptors. The estrogen and progesterone receptors, if patients have those, then that shows evidence that the tumor can be stimulated by estrogen therapy, not so much by progesterone therapy, but by estrogen therapy. HER2 new receptors is a whole different category, and there's another set of medications, trastuzumab, otherwise called Herceptin, and other medications such as pertuzumab and T-DM1 and lapatinib, but I won't focus on those at this time, but we can discuss those in question time if those come up. So I'll first start off talking a little bit about adjuvant therapy, and to define that, the situation where surgery has been done or is going to be done, and that might cure a patient, just the surgery alone or the surgery and radiation, the local regional treatment, but the patient is at risk for recurrence of cancer. They might already be cured, but they're at risk for recurrence. And it can be varying degrees of risk. It could be a 2% risk, or it could be a 80% risk, if you will, with local regional therapy alone. And so the question, many times we've given some drug therapy, either before or after the surgery is done, the local regional therapy is done, to try to increase the chance that there will cure the patient and they won't have any recurrence of breast cancer 5, 10, 15, 20, or more years after that. So when I started off in this business, tamoxifen started to be used and was first used for a year in the adjuvant setting and benefits were seen. And then trials were done to show that 2 years was better than a year. And then trials were done to show that 5 years was better than shorter periods of time. Over time, tamoxifen got compared to aromatase inhibitors. These are drugs that are utilized in postmenopausal women. They prevent the body from the adrenal gland that makes testosterone that can get converted into estrogen. It prevents that conversion. It doesn't prevent the estrogen synthesis through the ovaries, so it does not work in premenopausal women. So data showed that, actually, if you compare aromatase inhibitors to tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors might be a bit better than tamoxifen, although they're fairly similar. And then data showed that if you gave a patient who had had 5 years of Tamoxifen, if you randomized them to get an aromatase inhibitor, anastrozole was the drug first used in the situation, versus a placebo for 5 years, this is actually letrozole, a different one given, for 5 years, that you got benefits, and substantially more patients did not get recurrence of breast cancer during that period of time. So more recently, people said, how long should we continue the aromatase inhibitors, and how long should we continue Tamoxifen? So new data actually suggests that Tamoxifen can be helpful out to 10 years as opposed to just giving it for 5 years. But new data looking at aromatase inhibitors after Tamoxifen, there was a report published in the New England Journal of Medicine and presented at the ASCO meeting last summer that looked at 1,918 patients, so close to 2,000 patients. And there were patients who, most of them had had 5 years of Tamoxifen, and then they had 5 years of aromatase inhibitor. And they were randomized to get 5 more years of an aromatase inhibitor versus a placebo during those last 5 years. Now, not all the patients had 5 years of Tamoxifen first, so that everybody had a 5 years of aromatase inhibitor. So they randomized these patients to each group, and if you looked at how they did, and this was the report that came out last summer, in terms of 5-year disease-free survival, so 5 years after they started, how many of them did not have any recurrence, 91% of patients were doing well in the placebo group, versus 95% in the letrozole group. So it improved things by about 4 percentage points. If you look at overall survival, whether the patient's alive or not, at the 5-year mark, 93% versus 94%, not a significant difference, and actually the 94% was in the placebo group. So no change in survival. So if they look at the overall period of time that the patient was on study, in the placebo group, 10% of them had a recurrence. Now, I just said 9% on the previous because that was at the 5-year mark, but this went longer for some patients. Versus with the letrozole group, 7% had a recurrence. Now, so a 3% difference here. Now, it turns out that the recurrences they had was 1% more in terms of metastatic breast cancer, so breast cancer that had spread to some other area of the body, such as the lungs or the liver or the bones, 6% versus 7%. And the other difference was 1% versus 3% in terms of the patients who developed a new breast cancer in the other breast. So it changed that by about 2 percentage points. At the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, which was held this last December, it's in December of every year, there were 3 more studies that looked at longer duration of aromatase inhibitors. And their conclusions were that they saw maybe a trend like this last trial, which technically was statistically significant in the last trial because there were so many patients on board there. But there were trends, but not significant trends. So the end conclusions from the experts who looked at things here is that aromatase inhibitor is good after people have been on Tamoxifen, and that's a reasonable thing to do for 5 years. To extend to 10 years should not be for every patient. Aromatase inhibitors have quite a bit of toxicity for some patients. It can cause some joint aches and pains and some thinning of bones and vaginal dryness things. And a lot of patients, even on these clinical trials, only about 60% of them were still taking the pill after 5 years. But for patients who are at high risk for recurrence, like multiple positive lymph nodes, then it's reasonable to consider that. And also patients who are tolerating the medication well, not having a lot of bone and joint aches and pains and a lot of bone loss. And also with patient consent for them to actually know the numbers and the risks sort of thing so they can decide whether or not that's helpful for them. So I'm going to switch bases here a little bit now. And instead of talking about adjuvant setting, I'm going to talk about metastatic disease settings. So this is patients who have breast cancer that has recurred or is spread to other areas of the body. There are multiple drugs and approaches that have been used over the years to try to interfere and to try to make things better. So interfere with the breast cancer and make things better for the patients. And I already talked about Tamoxifen. We talked about the aromatase inhibitors a bit. There are 3 of them out there, anastrozole, letrozole, and exemestane, otherwise known as brands Evlorinidex, Femara, and Aromacin. There are progesterone, anti-progesterone medications that we used to use in the past, and androgen agents that we also use sometimes. And there's another medication called fulvestrant, which helps to destroy the estrogen receptor. And even, interestingly enough, we sometimes give estrogen back to people, and it sounds very, very strange, but sometimes higher doses of estrogen can scoop the cancer up and make it shrink down. And then lastly, in premenopausal women, we try to suppress ovaries to get rid of the estrogen process. So we have all those things, and they do work remarkably well in a number of patients, but not everybody and not for always. We have, more recently, people have tried to look at, can we use other more targeted agents to try to improve how patients do in this particular setting. And there's two new classes of drugs, and they're complex names, and I'll try to go over them quickly here for you, but one of them is called an mTOR inhibitor, small m, capital T, capital O, capital R, mTOR inhibitor, which is the mammalian target of rapamycin. I didn't come up with the name, but somebody else did. It's called Everolimus, the one that's around and about otherwise brand name of Afinitor. And then there are CDK4/6 inhibitors. Palbociclib or Ibrance is the one that's available now. So let me talk first about the mTOR inhibitors, and now I'll get to the CDK4/6 inhibitors. So studies were done in the recent past that showed that if you took a patient who had failed an aromatase inhibitor, or technically the aromatase inhibitor had failed them, so they had disease which was growing while they were on an aromatase inhibitor, and they randomized patients to get a different aromatase inhibitor than the one they had received. They received exemestane in this particular trial, versus then they got that either alone or that plus this everolimus medication. And then they watched and saw, and it was a blinded thing, so the doctors and patients didn't know what medication they were on. And they found out that they looked at the time until the cancer had started to cause trouble again, had progressed, if you will. And it was 4 months in the patients who received the aromatase inhibitor alone versus 10 months in the patients who had received both of the medications. And that was a pretty wild, big difference in those patients. And so, and that's, again, the average, and some people got much more benefit for longer, and some got less benefit from that average, if you will. Now, the medications, this medication has some side effects. We talk about targeted agents, and hopefully we would just target the cancer itself and not get much in the way of side effects, but that hasn't panned out exactly like that. And the main side effect that people get is mucositis, mouth sores, which can be quite painful. And in the trial where they were looked at, this last sort of trial, they were seen in about 70% of patients or so had mouth sores. About 30% of patients didn't have them. And they had them to varying degrees. A lot of them had very substantial mouth sores, which really interfered with how they could eat and that sort of thing. New information has come out that if people give a steroid mouthwash, dexamethasone or another corticosteroid, which you put in the mouth, squish it around for a couple of minutes, and then spit it out. You don't want to swallow it all the time because you get too much of the corticosteroid medication systemically. That can dramatically decrease the mucositis down from 70% down to about 25%, and that 25% that they get is much less substantial than much less severe. So at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, there was another trial that looked at this medication, this everolimus, to people who were getting fulvestrant. So these are people in whom they had been on an aromatase inhibitor and their disease had progressed just like the other group of patients. And they randomized patients to get fulvestrant versus fulvestrant plus the everolimus. And the first group got fulvestrant plus a placebo. And that improved how they did from 5 months till when the disease had progressed in the people who got the fulvestrant alone to 10 months of people who got it with the newer medications. So, again, the same thing with mouth sores in that situation, but that's just another area where we could think about using this particular medication. It's not FDA approved for this latter condition, but may well be. So then moving again to the CD4-6 inhibitors that I talked about just a bit ago, palbociclib is the one around. It's been shown that in the first-line setting, so if patients first have metastatic breast cancer and they haven't been treated for it, they were randomized to get an aromatase inhibitor versus an aromatase inhibitor plus palbociclib. And the progression-free survival improved from 10 months to 20 months. They're longer because they weren't resistant to other treatment like those other studies I just talked about. And in later settings, when patients had failed an aromatase inhibitor or the aromatase inhibitor had failed them, they were randomized to fulvestrant versus fulvestrant plus palbociclib. And that improved how they did from 5 months to 10 months. This medication is much better tolerated than the everolimus in terms of mouth sores. It doesn't cause much in the way of mouth sores or other side effects that way. It can cause blood counts to get lower, and so that requires a number of people to get blood tests relatively frequently, every couple of weeks during the first couple of months, and then maybe once a month or afterwards. And occasionally people can get infections. And then the other side effect that I put down here is that they're quite expensive. Each of these medications, the everolimus and the CDK4/6 inhibitors, are quite expensive. Insurance pays for whatever insurance pays for. So at this new San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, they looked at another medication, abemaciclib, which is somewhat like palbociclib. It's a newer drug there. And they looked at patients that had breast cancer. Now, they looked at a little bit different scenario and something we call neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So neoadjuvant, this is where I talked about adjuvant before, after surgery's been done. And when we give the drug before surgery, we call it neoadjuvant therapy. So they took 220 patients, and then they asked them to participate in the study. They randomized them to three arms. One was to get an anastrozole, which is the aromatase inhibitor. The other one was to get the abemaciclib alone. And the third arm was to get both of them. And what they looked at is they took a biopsy of the cancer before they started, and they looked under the microscope to see how many of the cells were dividing or were thinking about dividing. And that's something called a Ki-67 test, Ki-67, Ki-67. And they looked at how much that decreased with three different medications. And when you give the anastrozole, it decreased by more than half. It decreased by 63%. When you give the abemaciclib, it decreased by 91%. And when you gave both, it decreased by 93%. So all of this suggests that it is more effective against the breast cancer. So it was an early study, but it's exciting information for us, and then it'll need to be looked at further on to see whether it actually helps patients and prevents them from getting recurrent breast cancer and that sort of process there. Now, the side effect of this medication, you do get some low blood counts, not quite as much as what you got with the palbociclib, but you can get quite a bit of trouble with diarrhea in this situation, but there's a medication that can be given to try to counteract that. So that's a quick overview of the information I have regarding new things on estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, and I'll turn things back over to Dr. Messner to carry on from there.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lipinski. That was very, very comprehensive and excellent. Thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and our next presenter, our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira. Dr. Shapira is Associate Professor of Medicine, Stanford School of Medicine, Director, Cancer Survivorship Program, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Shapira is going to really address understanding the role of diagnostic testing and precision medicine. And we'll also address managing the treatment side effects. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Shapira.
Caroline, I thank you, and hello to everybody on the call. I'd like to start by talking a little bit about what we mean when we talk about precision medicine. It refers to interventions to prevent, diagnose, and treat disease, in this case cancer, that are based on molecular or mechanistic understanding of the cause and the characteristics of the disease, and where individual traits or characteristics of each patient, each person, are sufficiently different that the intervention can be directed towards those who will benefit, sparing others the expense, toxicity, and side effects. And that's a wonderful concept. If you think about it, the term precision medicine is new, but the concept has been part of healthcare for many years. For instance, if somebody needs a blood transfusion, they would routinely not be given just any blood from a random donor, but the blood is tested in order to match the blood type. So if you think about that concept, precision oncology and precision medicine is now taking all of the advances that we've made in understanding the human genome. And that is not just what we've inherited, but also what genes look like in cancers as a result of multiple impact and interaction over the span of one's life between our genes, the environment, anything that we have encountered during those years. So when we talk about precision oncology and precision medicine for cancer, we're talking about analyzing somebody's tumor with the goal of identifying what we call actionable mutations that drive the growth of that cancer. When we do research in this area, and this is really, really important to understand, the assignment to a particular treatment is based on recognizing those mutations that we believe are driving the growth of the tumor. So the goal of these clinical trials and this research is to help us understand how we can better target either one drug or a combination of drugs, and how we can better effect what we want, which is to control and get rid of cancer cells, and also understand how those cancer cells perhaps become resistant to those drugs. This is the way we're thinking about targeted interventions, and hopefully with the use of newer targeted drugs and immunotherapy, we will really be able to expand the options of treatments. So the trial assignment is made based on the identification of these mutations. And often these drugs are given in the preoperative or neoadjuvant setting, which really helps us understand how they act. So there is a pathway here that becomes the focus of interest. And the pathway is often sort of attacked, if you think about it, as a strategy by using drugs that may act at different steps along that pathway, with the understanding that it's that pathway that is activating and driving the growth of the tumor. And the difference between these targeted therapies and approaches from what we routinely know as chemotherapy is that chemotherapy are drugs that perhaps hurt cancer cells a little bit more than they hurt normal cells, but have a lot of toxicity because of the impact on normal cells as well. Whereas we hope that as our treatments become more and more refined, the targeted therapies will have less toxicity, and we also hopefully sometime will be able to choose them so the toxicities are not overlapping. In other words, so that we don't pick a combination of drugs that seem to hurt the same organ, such as the bone marrow or the nerves. So one of the main hopes we have with this precision oncology and precision medicine effort is really to minimize toxicities. And this is a concept that was discussed a lot in San Antonio. And in fact, our colleague Eric Weiner touched on this when he gave a very moving McGuire lecture. And he said we need to carefully consider toxicities when we are dealing with small benefits. And that's what I'd like to discuss right now, which is to understand sometimes how we think and we talk in our clinical setting, how patients and clinicians talk about what is the expectation of benefit and what a person is prepared to sacrifice in terms of side effects and toxicities. So as we think about this, let's think about managing and what the most important side effects are of many of the treatments. Dr. Laprinzi referred to hormonal therapies, and hormonal therapies will immediately evoke in many of those listening to this call the very dreadful menopausal symptoms. And those are symptoms that are very common for women who are given antiestrogen therapy, and they matter. And they matter because they impact on quality of life, and they may interfere with sleep, with function, with mood, with sexual function, with comfort. But they also matter because when they become intolerable, some women prefer not to take them. So by stopping the treatment, they also will not get the benefit of that treatment. So I think that we need to really think quite strategically about how to manage them and also how to talk about them, because it's quite obvious, for instance, that if the menopausal symptoms get better, people's quality of life will be better, but that is in the moment, and they may be sacrificing perhaps a benefit that they would only see many years later. talking about side effects, I was very excited to hear the results of a randomized clinical trial evaluating a new method for cooling the scalp and preventing hair loss. We know that there are scalp cooling devices that are already FDA approved, but this particular study that was presented by Dr. Nangia was a randomized trial using a different mechanism called the Paxman device, and that is a very interesting system where there are sort of two caps that are attached to the scalp. And what they saw is that it was quite effective, in fact, in preventing hair loss for women who were receiving chemotherapy, especially if they were receiving taxanes. We knew from before, and the study confirmed, that women who were getting drugs in a different category called anthracyclines, and one of the drugs you may recognize in that category is adriamycin, are probably going to lose their hair, even if they use a scalp cooling device. But women who are getting taxane-based chemotherapy had very good results. And I think that's also some reason to celebrate. There was more hair retention with taxanes, and the number they got was 65%, which I think is pretty good. Thinking about how to talk about expectation of benefit or possible side effect, another study that I was very impressed with came from Dr. Jaxie's group in Michigan, where they did a prospective study, and they looked at something that we often talk about but know very little about and has very little evidence for, and that is how receiving radiation after mastectomy will impact on outcomes. So they looked at women who had had reconstruction, and they actually found that those who receive radiation after reconstruction, especially after implant reconstruction, had a higher rate of complications. I'm saying this not to scare anybody who has to receive radiation, but only to raise our awareness of the fact that sometimes we really need to think about toxicities and if perhaps the expectation of benefit from that particular treatment, whether it's radiation or chemotherapy or hormonal therapy, is very small, then I think it becomes much more reasonable to say, you know, no thank you to that treatment. So that's what I wanted to mostly talk to you about, and then just mention a few other things that I found interesting at this meeting. One of the nagging problems that patients experience after being treated for breast cancer, especially those that get chemotherapy, is this horrible complication of neuropathy. And that's something that my colleague and my friend Dr. Loprindy knows a lot about. This was looked at in one study from Dana-Farber, which was a very small study, but they used acupuncture. 8-week intervention, and they found that women who received acupuncture, many of them were helped, and they rated their symptoms of neuropathy as being less severe. So this shows you that perhaps we can also be creative in our approaches and try to individualize the treatment for managing side effects, just as we're trying to get more precise and personalize the anti-cancer treatment itself. There was also interest in one of the other dreaded complications, and that is lymphedema. Fortunately, we're seeing a lot less lymphedema, but there's still a lot of interest in trying to figure out when we should be measuring arms, how we should be measuring arms, and whether or not certain medical procedures, such as drawing blood, could make things worse, or whether perhaps using compression early on might make it better. And we still don't know very much, but I think that it's important to see that we are understanding a little bit more about risk factors for lymphedema. It looks like, you know, clearly the more treatment you've had, the greater the risk. The women who've had nodes removed and then get radiation are more at risk. Women who have higher body mass index, meaning women who are perhaps larger in size, are more at risk. So understanding this, I hope, over the next few years will give us a better roadmap for knowing who's at risk and what we can do to modify that risk. there was a big call for increasing physical activity, and I think that's terrific, but I also think that it's important, and I think the science is getting us there in this spirit of trying to be more precise and understanding what it is about physical activity that we're looking for. I think we focus too much on weight for many years, and the data is starting to emerge that it's not just weight that matters, but muscle mass. So I think that as we go forward, we're going to hear more about bone and muscle mass in addition to how physical activity really impacts on reducing risk and improving well-being. So I'm going to stop there to give us a chance to talk a little bit about just how to communicate with the healthcare team and how to understand quality of life based on what I just told you. I think that just as the research community in oncology is moving towards more precise diagnosis and personalized recommendations, we need to forge better partnerships between clinicians and patients so we can understand what matters most to the individual patient. Some people may be willing to take more risks. Some people may be minimalists when it comes to treatment. So helping to have a clearer dialogue about expectation of benefit and understanding toxicity, I think, will help, especially when the expectation of benefit is very small. Dr. Laprinzi gave us this great example of how we are trying to figure out just how long they ask women to take aromatase inhibitors. So if in some cases the expectation of benefit after 5 years is very small, but the risk of the recurrence is high, the conversation about whether to continue or not may be different for a woman who, for instance, feels fine on the medication, but for a woman who's having a very hard time just getting through the day because of side effects. So as you think about communicating with your healthcare team, I think it's important to ask and really understand what you're being treated for, what the options are for treatment, what the expectations are for benefit, and then having a very clear idea of what the side effects are and how to manage them. Getting support from peers or buddies or others who've been through the treatment may be very helpful. Being referred to for acupuncture or for a social work consult or support may be very helpful in bearing symptoms. Medications such as venlafaxine, for instance, may be helpful in minimizing the dreadful hot flashes that some women have. And sometimes actually medications or new interventions to treat neuropathy may make a difference in how you bear that symptom. So it's important, I think, for everybody to really think about their quality of life, think about their preference for more or less treatment when there are options, and to keep a very fluid line of communication with the members of the cancer team. Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'll turn it back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Shapiro. That was wonderful and very informative, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and we're about to take questions. Before we do that, I just want to say a few words about the psychosocial support that everyone can access from cancer care. So cancer care, many of you may know already, but cancer care is a national organization, and we do provide a whole menu of services, actually, and you can pick and choose the ones that are best suited for you, from practical and financial assistance, educational programs, and also counseling services. And many of you access our counseling services on the telephone through our 800 number, 1-800-813-4673, and also through just individual counseling or couples counseling or partner counseling. We also offer online support groups. We have about 145 online support groups on many different types of groups. So that's something really worth your checking into. And we also do a great deal of telephone support groups, which, again, for national people all over the country, not having to travel to a group meeting or to an online group meeting makes such a big difference. Using the technology of a phone, having a phone, just being on a phone with a group of people, or having being on an online support group. And these groups actually help to address some of the concerns that we've kind of heard about people today dealing with, dealing with just the treatment of cancer, its side effects, talking, how do you talk just thinking about how one poses or organizes one's questions to the healthcare team. Also helping children and teens cope with cancer in the family, helping to talk with your boss about your cancer and getting the legal protections that exist for you in the workplace. It's really important for you to be informed about all of that. So it's really, you name it, and you probably offer a service on that. So for anyone who's struggling with the personal, the emotional, the social aspect, or just the practical aspect of coping with breast cancer, any type of cancer, this would be a good go-to place to call just for that type of support. In addition to that, we do offer these programs. Many of you have signed up for them, and of course, getting the information on the telephone is, of course, for most of you are online, much easier than going to an on-site workshop when you think of just the scope of this country and all the people all over the country as well as internationally as well. So with that being said, and most importantly, we don't want anyone of you to feel alone in coping with cancer, with breast cancer. We want you to know that you can call, in addition to your healthcare team, that you can call this organization and have a chance to talk to somebody for free about some of your concerns. Now with that being said, now we do have time for questions, and we actually have a lot of time for questions, so I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and also to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question comes from Stephanie F. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for your seminar. Again, Dr. Messner is excellent. I had 2 lumpectomy surgeries 10 years ago with chemotherapy and radiation, and I developed peripheral neuropathy from the Taxol medication and lymphedema from the surgeries and the radiation. My question is, I heard last time you talked about the scrambler machine to help, it's a tense machine to help with the peripheral neuropathy, and I'd like to also know, is there any studies being done on cold laser therapy for that? Also, can it be used with the lymphedema for both therapies? And I'd like to address that one. And also, there is studies also about anything but the alpha lipoic acid or any other medications for the peripheral neuropathy. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ashley, for that question. Stephanie, good to have you on the call. And I'm now going to have Dr. Lipinski, who actually is going to address your question. So I'm going to turn this, your question over to Dr. Lipinski, who will address your question because he has a great deal of knowledge in this area. Dr. Lipinski.
Thank you. Happy to address it. Big problem for many patients, specifically with taxane therapy for breast cancer. And you might get me on here for 2 hours talking because this is an area of my research interest. But alpha lipoic acid, studies done on that actually suggest that might make things worse. So I crossed that off quickly there. There is something called, there are things that can be done. Duloxetine is the one drug that's been FDA or been proven by clinical trials to be beneficial, although it's not very beneficial, but it's something worth trying for that. Gabapentinoid medications have been used a lot, but they, when looked at specifically for chemotherapy neuropathy, they don't appear to work very well at all. Scrambler therapy is something that I actually have been involved with for the last 5 or 6 years. It's a method that gives electrocutaneous things, a machine that looks something like an EKG-type machine, and it's done in the office, and you put leads on. And it dramatically works for patients who have some sorts of bad neuropathic pain. I didn't say chemotherapy neuropathy right there, but I said neuropathic pain in general. So it can work remarkably well for some patients. It's hard to know who it's going to work for or not. With regards to chemotherapy neuropathy, there are at least 2 pilot studies that have been published, and there's a 3rd one that had 36 patients, 33 of whom had chemotherapy neuropathy, where it appeared to be beneficial. They weren't randomized trial, didn't have a control group there. My group published one of those. Tom Smith at Johns Hopkins published another one of those. He was at Virginia Commonwealth University when he did it, and another group from Virginia Commonwealth University published the other trial. There are 2 trials ongoing at this time, randomized trials looking at this particular thing. We have one open at Mayo that randomizes patients to scrambler therapy versus TENS treatment, and then to see how people do. We're about three-fifths through approval on that particular trial. It does require a patient to be at a place that get it or dated for up to 2 weeks. It's not always covered by insurance. Some insurance companies pay for it, but not always covered by that. So there is a cost, and sometimes patients pay cash for it. Bottom line, it looks promising. It hasn't been proven yet for chemotherapy neuropathy. I've seen anecdotal cases where it has worked well.
Excellent.
I'll stop
thank
right
you. Well, thank you very much, and I know that's really helpful to Stephanie because it's a question that's it's an important question for everybody on the call as well. Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Mary O. Your line is open.
Hi, my name is Mary, and I was diagnosed at age 63 with de novo stage 4 breast bone. And I'd like to know if you know of studies that are about survivability being on Ibrance plus Vasodex.
Thank you for that question. And Dr. Spear, do you want to start with that? And then Dr. Lipinski?
So I'll turn that over to Charles. I think he addressed that in a particular aspect in his talk.
Okay. So yes. So metastatic breast cancer, we talked a bit about Ibrance, which is the brand name for palbociclib. And when used up front in somebody when they first got the therapy, were diagnosed with their breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, they might have had non-metastatic breast cancer before, and they got Ibrance versus an aromatase inhibitor, improved average time, so when the cancer was causing trouble, from 10 to 20 months. And when used after the aromatase inhibitor had quit working in some patients, then it worked, it improved things from 5 months to 10 months. In patients when Vasodex was given with this palbociclib medication. It's a little bit funny to be given up front with Vasodex and not get an aromatase inhibitor, and we didn't go into that detail, and we don't need to answer specific questions for each case sort of thing. But, so those are average numbers. Those are average numbers. In order to give a spectrum of things, you have to develop a bell-shaped curve around those average numbers, and there are some patients who don't get any benefit at all, and there are other patients who are doing well 2-3 years later, or sometimes potentially longer than that. So it varies from person to person. These average numbers help us determine, does it provide benefit overall? And then again, individual benefit is individualized.
Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, Helen. I took tamoxifen, and I'm going to actually address this question to Dr. Shapiro, and let me know if that's okay. I took tamoxifen for 1 year and Femara for 3 years, ending both early due to side effects that were very annoying and interfere with my good health. I become anxious because I did not take hormonal therapy for recommended 5 years, let alone 10. Could you please address if the 4 years were still effective in reducing the risk of recurrence? Thank you.
Yes, I'm happy to answer that. I was so eager to answer, I just jumped in before you even finished. But I think this happens a lot, and I think it's a very, very useful example because I'm pretty sure many others on the call have struggled with similar situations. So the answer is yes, you should feel very good about having stuck with it for as long as you did. And yes, you will derive a benefit. It's hard to know exactly how to give this a number without really understanding all the aspects about your particular presentation, because the risk of recurrence is based on many of the characteristics of that particular cancer, the biology of the cancer, the stage of the cancer, and all of the types of treatments received. Usually there's also surgery and very often radiation. So I would need to know all of that in order to try to figure out, you know, what you could be missing by not taking that extra year. But what I would like to say is reassure you that taking a year of tamoxifen and 3 years of an aromatase inhibitor is a very solid therapy. And then what I also wanted to address is the worry part and the anxiety part, because, you know, you could be anxious because of the side effects, you could be anxious because you're not taking the medication and you worry about what you're missing, but that anxiety isn't going to help you at all. So getting rid of that anxiety by perhaps having some counseling or by learning some mindfulness training or by talking to others or seeking some help is also important to maintain the best possible quality of life.
Thank you.
Let me add in there. I agree with everything that was said, Dr. Shapiro. You can, as she said too, you can individualize treatment. If a person had a one centimeter tumor and negative lymph nodes, then the benefit from the hormonal therapy is not that great anyway, because most patients do quite well. If they have 10 positive lymph nodes and a 4 centimeter tumor, that's a different thing. So all those things come into play. And again, trying not to worry is the best thing as possible.
Thank you. And I hope everyone heard that, because I think I this is something that we hear people concerned about. And indeed, I hope that this information helps you all to kind of put it in a context, and also just get some support so that you can, with whatever concerns and woes you have, talk with your healthcare team. Perhaps think about speaking to other members of the team, oncology nurse, oncology social worker, cancer care, all the other cancer organizations that exist out there that are listed on all the materials to get that additional support. Thank you. And our next question is one for Dr. Shapiro. It's an online question. I keep having hot flashes at night that are making me lose sleep. Is there anything I can do to relieve them? This is a question that comes up a lot, and I wonder if you could answer this in a general way, with some guidelines in terms of how one might deal with that.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, and then I also think we should loop Dr. Laprindian, because he actually has done some of the seminal work in clinical trials and understanding how drugs work. So first thing I'll say is that hot flashes are a normal part of menopause, whether you've had breast cancer or not, and the interruption of sleep is common in menopause, whether you've had breast cancer or not. It's much worse if you have to take anti-estrogen therapy, but it is sort of a common part of life. So the first thing to do is try to figure out how important it is for you, for each one of the folks who are suffering from it. One of the ways to think about it, and this is a technique Dr. Laprindian has used in some of his studies, is to sort of keep a journal of the symptoms. And in this case, if the sleep is interrupted, try to get an idea of, you know, how often you wake up at night, how many times this interruption in sleep occurs over the course of a week. So you sort of have a feeling of how often it's occurring, how severe it is, and then you have sort of your starting line when you talk to your clinician, because, you know, they'll want to know how bad it is, and you're the only one who can rate that. If the interference with sleep is then affecting how you feel during the day, if you have less energy, if you're very sleepy, then it may be that something needs to be done. You can live without doing anything and just sort of learn to deal with it. But if it is causing a major disruption, then usually we try to think about what can be done. One of the things that can be done is to take a sleeping medication carefully, not every night, but perhaps a few times a week. And the other is to consider doing something to diminish the hot flashes. Strenuous exercise helps women. Acupuncture can help women. And medications can help. And among the medications that have been tried to reduce hot flashes, there are, you know, two different kinds that we think of. One is some of the medications that were developed as antidepressants, and then lefaxine are favored. And then some of the other medications that were discussed before that we also use sometimes to relieve symptoms of pain, and that is the medications like gabapentin. So some medications work better for one person and others work better for somebody else, telling us that our brain chemistry perhaps determines sort of who responds to which medication. So I would say that perhaps having a stepwise approach, first trying to have a good idea of how bad the problem is, two, discussing it with a clinician, three is trying things that are non-pharmacologic, like exercise or maybe making the room cooler, and then thinking about whether or not you want to take a medication and if the medication should be something that addresses sleep specifically or something that is used to reduce hot flashes. And I'd love to hear how Dr. Laprindian would answer that question.
So I agree with you. And there are a number of things to do. The layered clothing is the other one. I was giving a talk once in San Francisco, and a woman said there in the wintertime when she had hot flashes, she just got in the car and then put the seatbelt on and then put her coat on backwards. And the reason why is if she got a hot flash, she could just take it off without taking her seatbelt off. So I thought that was kind of interesting on her when I was talking to a patient group there. But the antidepressant medications, venlafaxine is the first one we ever looked at. Citalopram, I think, Celexa, is a little bit less in the way of side effects, and I think it works about well, and that's the one I favor these days. The gabapentinoid medications, gabapentin or pregabalin. There's another one that was just recently brought out that is not well publicized, oxybutynin, O-X-Y-B-U-T-Y-N-I-N. It's a medication that people use for bladder troubles when they have leaky bladders. And there was just a randomized trial published in the last couple of months that actually supported that worked, and we're in the midst of doing a repeat randomized trial looking at smaller doses. An old blood pressure medication, Clonidine, works some, although it's doesn't use very often because we have these other things. And then the other thing is hypnosis. There are a couple of trials out there, randomized trials, supporting that hypnosis works. The only problem is there's not very many people who know the method for how we're going to do that. We need to get that out and about more. Acupuncture, the trials are mixed, although there are my colleagues here say at Mayo, there's a person who does acupuncture, and they've been impressed by what it does do. And then a quickly thing, soy. Most of the soy studies do not show benefit, and black cohosh, the same sort of thing. Vitamin E is probably just a placebo, or maybe a little bit more, but placebos do use them a little bit, and that's not very toxic. But those are the sorts of things to try, lots of things to try, and you have to be willing to say, I'm willing to take a medication for it, and sometimes the medication has some side effects for it.
So, thank you. And we have a question, a general question, which is, what are tumor markers? And Dr. Shapiro, do you want to address that? Just a little question about defining what they are. What are they?
So they're proteins that are mostly manufactured by tumors that are shed into the blood and can be measured by doing a routine blood test. They are not specific. I can't tell you that there are different tumor markers for different kinds of breast cancer. It's more of a yes, no. Some oncologists use them to measure the success of treatment when women have advanced or metastatic cancer. They are not really useful for women who have early breast cancer and women who are being treated initially with a hope of a cure. They are helpful in certain situations to help guide treatments and help decide if a treatment perhaps needs to be changed. But they are just, you know, one tool we have, and some oncologists put a lot of weight on those determinations, and others don't think it is that particularly helpful.
And Dr. Lupin, did you want to add anything?
So I agree with that. I think that I agree 100% with Dr. Shapiro that they're not useful in a patient who's been diagnosed with breast cancer, risk for recurrence, but doesn't have any known breast cancer. Having said that, a number of doctors do get them, but they're strongly recommended against by our society because they cause more trouble than benefit in that particular setting. And then in the metastatic disease setting, they can sometimes be helpful. Or sometimes, if a person had breast cancer and has a number of symptoms that I'm a bit suspicious that maybe they might be from related to recurrent breast cancer or not, then I think I can sometimes say on a 1-10 basis, let me get that, because if it's really high, then I have to worry more about breast cancer. But if it's low, then I'm better assured of that thing. But otherwise, I agree with Dr. Shapiro 100% on that.
Thank you. And we have a general question. This is Dr. Shapiro again on management of hand-foot syndrome. And the participant is using thick creams and Aquaphor, but my feet are still painful and hands are very dry. If you could just comment on that.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. And I don't know of anything that is better than doing what you already are doing, which is using emollients and creams. I don't know. Dr. Lupinzi usually is a fabulous source for knowing if there are new compounds that are being used in clinical trials. But in general, it's mostly a matter of trying to spare yourself the kinds of situations that will make it worse. So, for instance, we try to avoid cracking and peeling, so use gloves if you are washing dishes. Try not to expose your hands or your feet to extremes of temperature. Keep them moist, and if it really is a problem, and it is the result of taking a certain medication, usually hand foot is a we see a lot with the use of capecitabine, then it may be time to talk about either taking a drug holiday or reducing the dose or the schedule that you're taking it. Charles, I don't know if you have something, some wisdom about that.
Yeah, so years ago, we actually, there was some data that a uric acid cream, lactic acid urea-based cream would be helpful. We actually did a randomized trial looking at that versus a placebo, and actually saw a little bit more of the hand-foot syndrome in the people who got the cream. It probably exfoliated tissue there, kind of got tissue off there, which caused a problem for it. If it's with capecitabine, I actually try to tell all my patients if they're getting capecitabine, people take it orally, either for a week at a time or 2 weeks at a time, two different doses we use of those things. And it then allows the person to know, let me back up, different people metabolize the drug differently. So if people metabolize it very, very quickly, they can take more because it gets rid of it quickly, and some people don't metabolize it as fast. And this can help you with figuring out what's the right amount of drug that you can tolerate. So I tell all my patients, if I'm giving you capecitabine, if you get tender hands, I don't mind a little bit red, but if you get tender hands, or if you get watery diarrhea, you are to stop the medication and then call me. You are not to call me and then stop the medication, because sometimes I won't answer that call for a day or two because it's the weekend or that sort of thing. But that actually, so stopping it, and I have some, the only people I get in real trouble with this is the people who say, no, I can tough it out, I'm going to tough it out. And I really say, don't do that, don't do that. You're going to get a sore there, it's going to get cracked, it's going to get infected, and you won't be able to get the medication for months for that situation. So it is capecitabine, you know, that's the one thing that tells you your body's had enough of this medication, and that's what your body can tolerate, and hopefully that amount will fight off the cancer. More, getting more, in my mind, doesn't help the cancer, make the cancer, it doesn't cause the cancer to shrink down more, but just causes more side effects. So that's how I read it.
Thank you. This will be our last question. So it's a more general question about breast screening. During recommendations, and I'm going to give that to Dr. Lipinski and Dr. Shapiro. Varying recommendations on breast cancer screening and breast density as it relates to breast cancer risk of screening for breast cancer. So a question always about screening for breast cancer. And I guess there is another question with that in terms of if one has breast cancer, what about screening for oneself, but also for family members and that as well. So I guess in concluding, those are often issues that come up, and this caller is question is, has both of those components to it. Lipinski, did you want to go first? Or?
So you want me to answer that in less than 3 hours? So it's a tough question and all that sort of thing. There's lots of different variables there and lots of different recommendations that have been made over the years. We're not doing more studies because nobody's going to do more studies, but they're reanalyzing the other ones. And everybody who's coming up with recommendations is doing it with a good thought process of that. And if we screen too much, then you get too many of these, you know, too expensive, and you get more radiation, and you get little things that are never going to affect the life of a person and that sort of thing. So getting the right mixture in there is tough. Sometimes for women who have dense breasts, then getting something else. There is molecular breast imaging that can be done that's available at some places, and MRIs, but you can't do MRIs on everybody. It's just not cost-effective for that thing, and you get and so you just can't. We can't handle that. There are some groups that MRIs are helpful in addition to mammography, and that is people with BRCA1 or 2 family members or other strong family histories, or people who had radiation for Hodgkin's disease 10 years prior, women of that nature, because they have a very high incidence of breast cancer. Lydia, let you take it from here.
Sure. So there is concern, and there is good data that shows that having increased breast density increases the risk of cancer because there's more breast tissue, and it also makes the interpretation of the mammograms more difficult. And in some states, you know, in recent years, women were, now by law, the radiologist needs to send a letter to the patient saying, hey, you know, you have increased breast density, and so the result of the study may not be as good, and that has caused, again, a lot of anxiety, and, you know, maybe up to half the women get these kinds of letters. So the question is whether or not anything else needs to be done. And the answer to that is that it depends really on the assessment of risk. So if somebody has no other risk factors as a normal exam and has had normal mammograms, the answer is nothing else needs to be done. I think that we do have options for more intensive screening with MRI, which is a fabulous technology, but at this time it should be reserved only for very young women who are at high risk, or for such situations where the physicians and the cancer team really feel that it is important and it should not be offered sort of routinely to women, even women who've had breast cancer previously. So the issue of density is a legitimate concern, and the answer is that for most women with increased breast density, there is nothing else that's needed, and for some, perhaps, it's an indication for use of MRI, but that needs to be discussed one-on-one with the physician, same as a good family history needs to be taken. And one of the things about family history that I've sort of learned recently is that we shouldn't just take it once. So this is something that needs to be revisited as families age, as perhaps new cases are discovered in the family. So that's something else that anybody who has been treated for cancer should periodically revisit with a cancer clinician.
Excellent. Well, I have to say, Dr. Lipinski, Dr. Nito, you really are excellent, and you also happen to be an excellent team, so we really want to thank you for your wonderful presentations and the way in which you presented today. It was really quite wonderful. I've been getting feedback from people just online. People can write, send in pieces here. They really have been very appreciative of your presentations and your style of presenting as well, being so collegial. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening to the call today as well, and those of you who've queued up and asked questions, both on the phone and online. And, you know, I know that there are many more questions that we could take. We could stay here all day, but I know that we all have other things to do, and I also want to stay within our time frame. So I just want to also let you know that if you have a medical question that you didn't get to have answered, then I usually recommend that you go ahead and call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237, or you can visit their website at www.cancer.gov, and they have a live chat feature. So for people both in the U.S. and internationally, you can pose your question, and one of the information specialists will then address it. And of course, your healthcare team. I don't want to rule them out either. You definitely want to speak to your healthcare team always about your questions. But I know sometimes many of you like to have a reputable place to go to ask your questions. Also, I just want to also say that we have many, many cancer organizations that are collaborating with us on today's program, both general cancer organizations as well as breast cancer-specific organizations. And each one of those also would be a wonderful resource for you. So that I would stay within that community of resources, and there's plenty of them there for you to get any questions. And of course, your healthcare team. I just want to stress that as well. However, if you also would like to take advantage of the cancer care resources, our oncology social work staff, our practical and financial assistance, our counseling services, our support groups, then I would go ahead and call 1-800-813-4673. And also you can visit us on our website at www.cancer.org, and you also would be able to then pose your question, and one of our oncology social workers will get back to you. Most importantly, as we're concluding today's program, I don't want anyone to think you're alone. You are now part of a lot of support services, and please take advantage of them, really. They're free, and they're a wonderful resource for all of you. In addition, we do have some interesting programs coming up, and I want to highlight just one of them. It's called Living with Cancer Throughout the Cancer Journey. It's a very comprehensive program, and it's actually on March 10th, this Friday, from 1:30 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And for anyone who wishes to participate, you'll be getting information about it. It's kind of a very comprehensive program, and I think particularly many of you may find that useful. So, with that all being said, I want to thank you for being all of you participating today on the call, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.